will come. We have got an agenda in front of us and the documents for the day. Ladies and gentlemen, all of you are here. You are indeed welcome. We have got a new temporary assistant secretary, Nosipho Bavuma. Welcome, ma'am. Just stand up so that you can be seen. You're quite tall, yeah. You'll remember that before we closed, I think we did raise an issue of an assistant secretary for Darren, especially now that we'll be starting with the budget. It's a very hectic year for this, hectic period in the year for this committee. Welcome, Ms. Bavuma. Dr. Mampo, we'll introduce your team. There is an agenda in front of us, and I think we can proceed on the basis of this agenda. Let's go. How much time do you need?
2 hours. I'm very prepared.
No, because if you say 2 hours, we may end up being left with only 1 hour too. Why don't we say 1.5 hour?
I'll do my best, Captain.
Yeah, to do that so that you allow the honorable members to engage. We like engaging.
Oh, the 2 hours includes engagement.
Eh?
It includes the engagement.
No. I was asking your presentation. Wow. How far it go? How long do you have?
30 okay. minutes. Okay.
Can go a little bit further than that, ne?
Okay.
Okay. Introduce your team and take it from there.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members. Today I decided to bring the ladies squad with me because it's the new year. So I have Ms. Levo, who deals with economic services. Ms. Bebes, she deals with health and social development. And Ms. Ulrika, who deals with urban infrastructure. So this is the team that is going to support me when we do the presentation for the third quarter. So, Chairperson, as you may remember...
We're a little bit too fast. Okay. Especially the new faces we are seeing here, so that we know exactly who is here. Then I need to start Lebu and then go.
Okay. Sorry. Ms. Lebu Madiba, she's the Chief Director responsible for Economic Services Department. So departments such as the DTI, Economic Development, Rural Development, Tourism, those form part of her portfolio. Then Ms. Bebeze, who is the Acting Chief Director, she deals with health, social development, and the Department of Women, Children, and People with Disabilities. Then Ms. Ulrika, she's the Chief Director who deals with departments that are highly infrastructure intensive, and those would be Department of Transport, Department of Human Settlements, and Water and Sanitation. So those will be the department that she's responsible for. So Chairperson, all in all, I have 6, but to cut costs, we just bring half of the team.
Okay, thank you. So the last time I saw you was in Botswana, am I right? Where was it?
Yeah,
it was in Botswana. Welcome back home. Okay. Welcome, Team National Treasury.
Thank you. So, Chairperson, today we bring in the third quarter spending outcomes for the different departments. Last time when we were with the committee requested us to provide information on provincial spending, especially for Gauteng, because the Gauteng provincial government was here. We did send through that information. I just wanted to check with the secretariat if they got the information. And another information you requested was the conditions associated with the appropriations for the state-owned companies. We did submit that information, but we also submitted updated conditions this morning. Please also check with Cindy so that you can forward to the committee. So, Chairperson, this time around, we decided to structure the presentation and focus on the departments that we think deserve your attention and not focus on all of them, because last time we were here, we focused on too many and we didn't really have time to discuss the ones that are a big problem. So, not a big problem, but the ones that we wanted to bring to your attention. So, basically, for the third quarter, what we have seen is that the spending to date was about 683 billion, and that represented an underspending of 14.4 billion, or basically 2.1% of the estimate. So, Chairperson and Honorable Members, how we do the estimate, I think we just need to explain, is that at the start of the fiscal year, the different departments will give us their drawing projections of how much they will draw per month, and we use that as an estimate of what they will spend vis-a-vis how much they draw at the end. So if in January they say they're going to draw down 20 rand per month over the year, we use that as a projected spending, and depending on how much they take out of the National Revenue Fund, that will be the actual spending. So if they take out 15, but they say they were going to withdraw 20, that means the underspending, the amount we're reporting on will be the difference between the 20 and the 15, which is the underspending. For some departments, yes, it is underspending, but for some, it becomes a technical adjustment that I'm going to explain just now. So basically, the biggest deviations that we have seen so far was in transfers and subsidies. So the mismatch between the drawings and the actual spending was 23.7 billion, and followed by goods and services. But as you will remember, Chairperson and Honorable Members, last year you approved a special appropriation bill for ESCOM, and the ESCOM guys have given the Treasury the drawing schedule of how much they're going to draw the 23, because it wasn't going to be in one lump sum. So in this quarter, you will see that the financial assets were more than anticipated by 13 billion, but that is mainly the withdrawal of ESCOM rather than us paying for something new. So what happens is that when you approve the special appropriation, then we had to go back and look how much can the state afford to disperse the funds during which month. We worked with ESCOM so that they don't have cash flow problems. So they've withdrawn 13 billion this quarter, and the rest of the money they will draw down in the following quarter. So when I come back for the full year, the full amount will be withdrawn and the books will balance. So this is more of how do we dispense the funds to ESCOM. So, Honorable Chair and Members, the first department that we're looking at is Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs. So there has been a lot of cry on how do we help municipalities deal with the debt that they have, deal with the payment, deal with the management, the governance. So one of the divisions at the Treasury and the Provincial Treasuries plus the Department of Quarter came up with a strategy to help the municipalities to budget better. So when we started the fiscal year, when they looked at the different municipalities, there were about 127 municipalities that funded, or that table unfunded budgets. So basically that means they made budget, or they proposed budgets that were not fully funded. If a municipality does that, it means they won't have sufficient funds during the year to pay off their overall budget. So basically what we have done, we send them back and we ask them to adjust their budget so that they remain within what they can be or what is allocated to them. So at the by the time we got to the December allocation, 61 of those municipalities adopted the funded budgets, and they were given all their conditional grants and equitable share. But there were some municipalities at that time, which is about 66, that still had unfunded budgets. So what the Treasury and the Provincial Treasury did was to help them identify cash liquidities during the year so that they can pay off the debt, especially for ESCOM. So after that exercise, we had about 29 municipalities that still didn't submit the unfunded, the funded budget, and that was in December. So in December, the department held, or they didn't transfer the conditional grant money for the 29 municipalities. But when I come back in the fourth quarter, for most of these municipalities, they would have transferred the fund if they managed to change their budget. But I think one thing that I need to clarify, Chairperson and Honourable Members, is that the year or the fiscal year for municipalities is different from ours. So it's June to June rather than April to March. So even when we disperse the funds in March, they still have another quarter to spend the funds. So we're not worried that we're delaying the funds for them not to spend, but we're just trying to make sure whenever we disperse the funds, at least they have budgets that are sustainable and they don't incur the accruals, especially for ESCOM and the Water Board. So we're just trying to resolve the interdepartmental accruals by doing this process. So far it has been working, but we're keeping a very close eye on the ones that are unable to do that so that we can assist them with the provincial department so that they can have funded mandate. As a result, this department showed an understanding of about 2 odd billion. Then another department, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, that showed a bit of an understanding, and we're working very close with this department, is the Department of Higher Education and Training. And this basically is because the universities didn't submit their progress report on time, therefore the department couldn't disperse the conditional or the grants that are listed in the first bullet. But we think that because they have submitted most of what is required, most of these payments will be processed in the fourth quarter, and we don't see significant underspending in the fourth quarter. But this is another department that, as the Treasury, we're keeping a close eye on. Then for social development, Honourable Members, the underspending was about 14.6 billion, but basically this is just a technical adjustment. So if the first of each of the following month is a holiday, it means they have to withdraw the money on the 31st of the month. So basically they withdrew the money in December, but for the social grants of January. That's why it shows the underspending. But when we come back with the recon, there will not be such deviations because it will be the full year. So there's no problem in social development. It's just that when they gave us the drawing schedule, they gave us for much more in December because of the holiday in January. But the social grants were paid. There's no, this doesn't mean that they were not paid. It's just a technical adjustment because of the holidays. Then we have another department that we're looking very closely at, and this is the human settlement. They have been recording underspending, and these are in the urban settlement development grant. And basically this is mainly because of non-compliance with the Division of Revenue Act on the human settlement development grant. So basically what we try to do with them also is we're trying to help them adhere to these conditions, and we're hoping that in the fourth quarter most of the funds will be transferred. But this is another department that we're really looking at. And then for public enterprises, as I explained earlier, you will see that it showed overspending, but the overspending is because of the approval of the special appropriation bill. And by the time we reach the full fiscal year and we disperse all the funds and do the adjustments, we don't think that this department will overspend. So mainly this is just the 13 billion of the 26 that was allocated in the Special Appropriations Act. Then the Department of Transport also showed a bit of overspending for the first three quarters of 2019-20, but this is mainly because they paid the conditional grant transfers for the provincial road maintenance grants and the public transport network grants, and these were made much earlier than projected. So they will have to change their payment schedule so that they align to the payment. But this is not that they misspend, it's just that the transfers were done earlier than what they said they would do. And then in science and technology, the overspending was also on the different grants that we give to them and also to the entities. And this is mainly because the payments were made earlier, but we're not worried that there's going to be overspending. But the department also withheld some of the processing of the funds for this project, and this is mainly due to failure by the implementing agencies to submit their performance reports on time. So I think what the department was trying to do was to adhere to the PFMA, where you don't just disperse the funds, but you make sure that the documentation and the reporting is proper before you disperse the funds. But once this is done, and the good thing is that this is still in here, in the fourth quarter we don't think we'll have different problems. Then, Chairperson and Honorable Members, for small business, as you remember, two budgets ago, there was an allocation for the Small Development Fund. So what happened was this year was supposed to be the first year where the fund was utilized, so the department decided to use an agency to implement the fund. So basically they have transferred about 664 million of the 700 million, but this was transferred earlier than what we thought, because we, when they were doing the drawings, they thought they would spend the money in the third and in the fourth quarter, but they transferred most of the money. But going forward, we don't see that there will be an overspending by the department. So it's just an early transfer, and it's not something wrong or something to worry about. All we need to monitor in this is how the 700 million is utilized and whether it does get to the small businesses. So what we have asked the department is that on a quarterly basis they must report to the Treasury and show us how they are dispersing the 700 million to the small businesses, so that we know that we can follow the funds. Because if you use an agency to do the work, it's difficult for us to monitor. So with this quarterly report, I can come back to the committee and say the department has dispersed 100 million of the 700 million, and these are the different businesses that they disperse the funds to. So those quarterly reports will help me come back and report on the progress of the 700. Because how it looks now, it looks like the department has spent the 700, but it's merely a transfer to another entity. So we need to make sure we follow the funds, and I think the quarterly report will definitely help us. So, Honorable Members and Chairperson, those are the departments that we wanted to bring to your attention. But what I also done this time around is just to show you that for most of the departments, by the third quarter, they spend over 65% of their budget. It's only at random, very rare instances where they spend less than 65%, and most of those can be explained. The one department that we sort of worry about would be the Rural Development and Land Reform, where they've been underspending in the third quarter for the past 3 years, but at least this year there was some improvement because they spent, or they withdrew 68.6% of their budget. So, Chairperson, with your permission, must I continue with the public entities or stop now and take questions for the National Department?
I think let's complete the presentation.
All right. No, thanks, Chair. So the first few slides on the public entities, Chairperson, is just a background information just to remind the Honorable Members of the different types of public entities that we report on, basically the financing, how they are financed, and the different challenges of reporting on these entities. So we're reporting on the second quarter performance of the entities because there's a two-quarter lag relative to the departmental numbers. So basically the first one, Chairperson, and this would be slide 6, the compensation fund. So as you would know, the compensation fund generates most of its revenues from the assessment levies on employers. This fund is sustainable, and the main disbursement or their main spending comes from claims, and this amounted to 1.5 billion. And this was slightly more than what they forecast, but basically it was them clearing the backlogs of the past, which is a good thing. And if you just look at their overall cash available at the end of the year, they amounted to 1.7 billion, which is sustainable for the fund. So the fund hasn't showed any reason for us to worry, given the fact that they're dealing with the backlogs, but they're also preserving some of the surpluses. If you look at Legal Aid South Africa, you realize that most of the amount that they received is coming from transfers from the state. And in the second quarter the transfers were almost a billion, but this was slightly less than what we thought. But basically, we're not too worried about the performance. They've also collected about 3.7 million of non-tax revenue, and this is mainly from the interest of the entity's bank reserves. The spending basically comes on compensation of employees, because mostly those will be the legal services that are provided, and the lawyers in the entity are classified as staff rather than consultants. So the spending there was about 831 million and the projected 789. The highest spending was basically the payment of bonuses in the second quarter, and this is usually reserved for the fourth quarter, but the entity decided to pay it in the second quarter. So overall in the year, we think this will balance through and we won't have too much of the problems when we're looking at legal aid. We have the National Empowerment Fund chairperson. So basically how they make their money is they get the interest on the loans that they issue, but also the repayment of the loans. So in total, or the total disbursements during the second quarter was about 96.7 million. This was much lower than the average of about 200 per quarter, and this is because they are still finalizing some of the deals and the documentation was still needed. So we think that the disbursements will improve considerably in the third to the fourth quarter. So this is still just half of the year. We think all of the admin issues that they have, they will deal with them in the next two quarters. But if you look at the overall cash that they have, it increased from 183 at the beginning of the quarter to about a billion. But as I say, during the two quarters, after they resolve the admin issues, then all of this will be sorted out. So basically, we expect the entity to remain profitable. The one thing that we do try and encourage the entity to do is not to recklessly give these loan disbursements. They must just make sure they're still sustainable, because once you issue more loans vis-a-vis the interest that you get, then you run into liquidity problems. Chairperson and honorable members, the National Health Laboratory Services was one of the entities that we used to worry about quite a lot, because there were a lot of disputes between the entity and the different government departments. So for the first time in a very long time, the entity has it increased their cash balances from 2.2 billion to about 4 billion. This basically covers 6 months of their expenditure, which is very good. So basically what happened was that the Gauteng Provincial Department settled and they paid the agreed settlement of about 150 million, but also most of the provinces paid what they're supposed to pay. Therefore, their cash basically improved from what they had before. So this is good, but it was one entity that we used to worry about. The National Research Foundation, honorable members, basically get their revenue from transfers from the Department of Science and Technology, and they also receive revenues from contracts from other government departments and entities, and also they receive some of their money from the interest received on the funds that they invested, so they're basically sustainable. And for the end of the second quarter, they had cash available of about 123 million, and they projected a deficit. So basically, this is quite good, because it means their cash translated to a 391 million increase. So we're not too worried about the performance of the entity precisely because their cash and cash equivalent is improving significantly. Then the skills, the National Skills Fund, as you know, they generate their revenue from the Skills Development Levy, and basically they receive transfers of about 12.9 million lower than expected, but mainly this is just an overestimate rather than not receiving the funds that they said they were going to receive. And in terms of spending, they spend about half a billion less than what they said, and this is mainly due to some delays in receiving progress report from the different institutions. But it happens during the course of the year that there will be delays, but we think by the end of the year there will be some rebalancing of the entity. But the entity hasn't indicated any sign of liquidity issues, so we're still happy with the performance of the entity. The National Student Financial Aid Scheme, basically there were some problems there, but with the administrator tried to reconcile as much as possible the students plus the universities. So if you look at the entity's financial performance, you realize that they've spent more, but this is because they were repaying the students from the 2018. So that's just the balancing. So the overspending there was 2.5 billion, but this is mainly due to the outstanding 2018 academic year funding claims. So they are sustainable, they have the money, the Department of Higher Education does transfer the funds, so it was just the administration. But we think once they deal with the backlog of 2018, then they will be running smoothly going forward. So we're not too worried about that. Honorable Chairperson and honorable members, I think you know the problems that Passenger Rail Agency of South Africa has, and you are aware that the Department of Transport has appointed an administrator to try and deal with the governance issues at PASA. They still have large cash reserves, but we're hoping that with the department's new strategy and the administrator, the spending on PRASA will start moving. But we always worry that the budget for PRASA needs to start moving so that it doesn't look like they have cash at hand, because they still need the infrastructure to, they still need to provide the infrastructure. So what we're hoping for here, and we've given the Department of Transport some time, is to see how the administrator will turn around the entity and fix the governance issues so that we can start seeing progressive spending on their infrastructure spend. The Road Accident Fund, Chairperson and honorable members, is insolvent. We know they can't afford to survive. Unfortunately, the road accident bill, the benefits, it is still in Parliament, so we're waiting for that, and once that is passed, then we still have to figure out what we do with the estimated 600 billion in actuarial estimates of how much we owe the people of South Africa who were involved in accidents. So even when the bill is passed and it becomes the Act, we still have to deal with the liabilities. And that's a discussion that we'll also have to bring to the committee's attention and help us on how to deal with such a big liability of the state. But so far, you see, if this year the Road Accident Fund levy is increased by 50 cents, it will still not be enough to pay for the claims of this year only, because the claims come up to 40 billion, and if you increase it by 50 cents, you get to about 33 billion. So you still have a gap that will pile up the 600. So it doesn't help to continuously increase the road accident fund levy without dealing with the bill itself, because the bill is what's going to help us to stop accumulating the liability. But we're hoping that since it's been revived and the Portfolio Committee on Transport will deal with the bill, we might start changing the way we do the scheme, because currently it's a false scheme, so it can be any amount that they settle for, and the lawyers make a lot of money on the road accident fund scheme because of the nature at which we designed it. So we think with the change we might see some progress there, but even then it's going to take us between 10 to 20 years as the state to get rid of the liability that we've already accumulated. So we still have a big problem. If you look at the magnitude of how much the liability is, you realize that in 2 years' time, if the bill doesn't get passed and it becomes an act, the road accident fund liability will be bigger than ESCOM's liability. So you have another very big fiscal risk, and that is through the road accident fund. South African National Parks, we're still happy with the entity. Nothing to report there. The projections are still proper, the income is still proper. If you look at the cash available at the end of the second quarter, it was 2 billion, and this was about half a billion higher than what they expected. So this entity is doing much well. The South African Revenue Services, Chairperson and Honorable Members, as you know, to strengthen it, we did allocate 1 billion over the MTEF, and we hope that they will use that 1 billion one to strengthen the people at SARS or to get back the strong people at SARS, but also to deal with their IT systems so that they can process most of these claims faster and they can detect some of the people that are avoiding taxes much easier. So with those allocations, we think the entity is stable, but we have bilaterals with the entity, so we are aware of what is needed, and we think what was allocated over the MTF will help them get to that point. We also had to basically look at, as you would know, for most of the department we have a compensation ceiling, but because SARS needed staff, we allow them to increase their compensation of employees. If you look at the last billion, the last bullet, basically they increased their compensation of employees by almost 200 million higher than what we projected, and this is because they are now recapacitating SARS, and this was short-term staff members. So basically what they do is during certain periods they will employ short-term staff members to do a particular project. So these are project-based rather than them being in the system. But we are monitoring SARS, and with the money that they have, we think they'll be sustainable for the year. With Sandral, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, we know the issues they have. We know that they struggle to go to the market to get money because of the GP. But their non-portfolio, we did allocate to them, and we think that they have to start moving. So the allocations, if you look at them, it would be the allocations for the N2 Wild Coast. Those were allocations that we did during the year, and we think that they can start moving, because an entity like Sandal is an entity that is capable of implementing, so we don't want the toll portfolio to interfere with the non-toll portfolio that they still have to do. So we did transfer money for Sandal to do the non-toll portfolio. But if you look at their finances, they're still really struggling because of the GPs and their inability to go and borrow at the market. The other entity that we sort of happy with would be the South African Social Security Agency, that is SASSA. They did manage to move from the CPS contract to the SAPO contract with minimal disturbances, and so far they have been dispersing the funds as requested. They still have some issues between the two entities, but we are part of the engagement and we're sorting them out. So far their cash balances were 2.1 billion, but this is because they're waiting for SAPO to issue or to give them proper reconciled statements so that they can disperse the funds to SAPO. But this is between the entities rather than affecting the disbursement of social grants. South African Tourism, they get most of their income from us. The Department of Tourism has transferred about 1.1 billion to one of their entities, the department has dispersed about 1.1 billion to South African Tourism, but basically they're doing fine and they don't have cash flow issues that we can pick up. And then lastly, Chairperson and Honorable Members, the Unemployment Insurance Fund still remains one of those social security funds with significant assets because they're dispersing less than what they're collecting. So basically their spending items is about, or payment of the beneficiaries for the fourth quarter was 8.8 billion, and this was 2.4 billion higher than what we estimated, and this basically is because of the Unemployment Insurance Amendment Act, which basically increased the benefits that have to be paid by the entity. But because of the assets that they have, we don't think that the change or the amendment act will affect their financial position. So we still fine with the entity, but we keep on monitoring just to make sure that they don't become insolvent. So, Chairperson, that is in short I hope, the summary of what I had to present today. The documentation, I hope that Darren has sent, is our full report that has the different votes and also the presentation that we circulated to the secretariat has the different presentation by vote. So we just thought, let's do the summary so that it gives the honorable members enough time to engage. But if you want additional information, it's in the presentation, but we can also supply any additional information that is needed. Thank you, Chairperson.
Dr. Mam, any reason why we don't report on SAPO?
No reason. We can add SAPO on the list.
Yeah, I'm sure you know why I'm asking, because it was in the news as an entity which may be coming to this committee for their proverbial bailout. So before I allow honourable members, I just think note that we definitely must be appraised as to what is happening there.
So Chairperson, it will come with the ESCOMs and the SAA, so I'll ask the team to edit. Thank you.
Let's do that.
Okay.
When I was welcoming the honourable members, Honourable Sarupen was not here. Honourable Sheikh was not here. Honourable Kumani was not here. Welcome, honourable members, and all of the best for 2020. And we introduced Ms. Pavuma as our new assistant secretary, at least up to the end of April. Okay, honourable members, I think you are itching to engage with the report. thanks, Dr. Mampo. We do have time, but can we do it this way? Maximum 5 questions. 5 minutes. So the question per minute is quite, you don't need to use a whole 5 minutes. I'm definitely going to be having my stopwatch on, and let's see how we engage. Can I get to the indication, Honorable Sarupen, Honorable Matafa, Honorable Joseph, Honorable Sheikh, Honorable Ntlangwini, Honorable Zembo, Honorable Peters, right, in that order, and lastly, Honourable Kaiso. Let's go.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be within my 5 minutes. I have 2 questions. The first is in regards to the NHLS. Are there any other provinces other than Gauteng whose payment or non-payment is affecting the cash flow and the balance sheet of the NHLS? Because I see that Gauteng is reported as having historical debts. What is the other situation with the other provinces? And then with regards to the Social Security Agency, getting back to the point that the Chair made, I see that the lower payment is as a result of non-payment to the South African Post Office, because they've not been able to reconcile beneficiary payments by payment channel. Was this not in the performance agreement between SASA and SAPO initially? And if so, was there any due diligence done on the contract? I would like to know. Thank you.
So, order, who's next?
Matafa. Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you for the presentation, and good morning to everyone. Chair, I just have a few questions. The first presentation on slide 4 and 5, COCTA and human settlement. I observed that there's a general underspending of grants. The first part was unconditional, and the second part was USDG, which is conditional. Now, I'm just worried by the approach that we are withholding the equitable share from municipalities, because that has a dire impact on service delivery, according to my understanding. And my view is that I think maybe that is too drastic, because in a way we are punishing the voters or the residents of those particular municipalities for the inefficiency of municipalities to spend. So maybe I think there should be a different approach in terms of how do we capacitate those municipalities. And I think mainly the problem is capacity building. So we just need to look at how we can assist those particular municipalities. NEFSAS and PRASA, I see there's underspending on personal compensation. So I think that is due to the vacancy rate. I'm interested to find out if whether these are critical skills. If yes, are we allowed maybe to headhunt for those particular skills? Because keep on advertising and not finding the capable candidate, it's a futile exercise if we do not put in a particular measure that will assist us in being able to attract those particular skills. Chair, let me stop with this one from Ref. It's surprising that the volume sold are less and have decreased, because when I drive, maybe it's not, there's no correlation. But I see a lot of filling stations that are popping up with funny names. So if these filling stations are popping up like that and the volumes are decreasing, what is the interest of these individuals opening these filling stations when they know they are not going to sell or they are not selling? So the direct question to us is, do we have a tracking mechanism of what quantities are actually sold at the initial stage from the mass producers to the filling station and what actually goes into the fuel tank of the vehicles on the road? Oh, yeah, the very last one, Chair. The IT system at SAP. This is a matter that has been in the news for quite some time, I think from 2016. It's interesting that we are still sitting with the same situation, that we need to improve on it. Is there a way that we can be benefited with a report of the current system? What values are we deriving? How was it procured? And if there's any maladministration in terms of how it was procured, maybe we need to reflect on that. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. I just would like to make a comment first about the small business. And I would like to see at the end of the financial year, out of that 700 million, because you spoke about the state, an entity managing that money. So I would like after the end of the financial year to see how much money did actually go to the small business and how much of that money was spent on the entity that have to manage that. That is what I would like to see. And then I would like to ask on PRASA, what is your projection on for the last quarter, the fact that there was underspending? And and maybe we must look at, when it comes to the adjustment budget, that we perhaps must do more to shift the money if we can clearly see there's a pattern and the underspending is too big in the second quarter. And then when we have to do the adjustment, we must maybe look at that as a proposal. On the road accident fund liabilities, Chairperson, I want to know if Treasury knows what is the depth of the legal expertise in that department. Because I think in departments where there's liability claims, even in the health, and in other departments, the important part is for legal people in that department to understand what that claim is about. If we do not have the correct expertise in that department, maybe claims will just be paid out without expertise in the department challenging that claims that comes in. And we've seen it in the health department, and I think or in the road accident fund between departments, you can see where the shift is of the claims. Maybe that is a research investigation we must do to see how the claims to government have shifted from department to other departments, and then we need to look at the legal expertise in the department that can actually challenge these claims. That for me seems to be can also be a solution going forward. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for that presentation. Let me start off by asking you to provide us a comprehensive list of those municipalities that are underspending in the urban development or urban settlement development grants, and perhaps the reasons that they are giving for underspending, and particularly those that are repeat offenders in terms of that. Now, the other thing is the Road Accident Fund. Given what you've just said, and you're the custodian of the funds, and you know the challenges we are facing, particularly in terms of corruption and collusion with the attorneys or legal fraternity in this thing, have you ever considered new direction or a new plan on how we should be dealing with road accidents? And let me give you a good example. Why don't we take it away from government and government's responsibility completely? Allow a percentage to be paid into your license fees for every motor vehicle on the road, and let that go to an insurance company so that they could manage it and they could pay the road accident fund and take away the responsibility of government, because it's common knowledge. Wherever there's government involved, people want to take us for a ride. So let's take that responsibility away to insurance companies, let them insure that, let that percentage that is being paid go towards premiums to insurance companies so that it's not a liability from government anymore. I want you to tell me whether you've ever considered, you know, anything or any suggestions that you are making, particularly in that. Now, Small Business Development Fund, and I think you've alluded to that, and you want to know whether the money is spent, because the money that's been gone to the agency. I think this committee wants a comprehensive list again, because on the ground, you see these monies that we're allocating and that is being received, it's not converted to delivery of the services on the ground. Now, people you speak to on the ground say there's so much of red tape, Chair, they can't get the funds for these small businesses. So the question we are asking now, who exactly is getting this money? Did they qualify? Is there specific people getting it because of who you know, or do they really qualify? Because why is it there's so many other people that are complaining that they're not? But if you give us these lists, we can then actually scrutinize it and see exactly this money is being used, who it is being given to, because we also want to know the success when you're giving these money. Is there success? Are these small businesses becoming successful or not? Or is it just doing what we're doing with Nestle's, where 60% of your money, 60% failure rate in the first year. So if you're allocating 60 billion, 36 billion, you're actually throwing it away in the bin. That's what it means, because 60% are dropping out in the first year. That's my interpretation of it. So these are some of the things. Then we're talking about, I think there's somebody here who is particularly in that. And let me also welcome the intervention in the National Health Laboratory Services and their turnaround. I think we must commend them for the work they did, because not long ago they were in dire straits. They were really, so I think we must welcome them. But let me, I want to ask specifically to the person responsible here in Treasury for health. I want you to tell us today if you really honestly in ABC language, and if you can spell it out, what, understand the implementation of this NHI. Because with everything I'm hearing, I want to be honest with you, I don't. And the people on the ground, particularly the medical fraternity, the doctors and things, are worried. They want to leave because we are not spelling out to them how this thing is really going to unfold, how they're going to be protected, how you're going to spell it out, given the fact that we have challenges. It's a brilliant thing and we must implement it. Question is when and whether we're ready for it. So I want you to tell me, because we've requested, and maybe Chair, through you, Chair, maybe we need to call the health to come and tell us exactly, because I have a lot of questions so that I can answer to people on the ground as well. Because everybody is evasive at this stage as to exactly what is going to happen. And all I'm reading is negative things. I want to hear the positive things. Okay, I think I'll stop there for now, Chair.
Thank you. Peter.
Thank you very much, Chair. Is it person? Oh, okay. Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you, Doctor, for the presentation. I think we won't be able to call all of the departments that were sort of red flagged by the National Treasury. But I think we should take a proactive approach
in writing to them that have deviations. Because if we're going to just leave departments with deviations, they will think it's right and do not follow the PFMA to the letter. So the ones that have flagged with some deviations on the on their budgets with a slow spending, low spending, and so forth, I think as a committee we should write to them and sort of seek an explanation. And then I want to concur with the gentleman there. The one of SARS have been coming on since last term with the software. So we want to find out, is it the same software program problem, or is it a new one? And why are they not budgeting effectively? Because that has been the explanation since last term on the software upgrades on SARS. And then I think the doctor didn't complete her whole presentation on the first one, because I see National Treasury there. And it's quite concerning to see National Treasury also with some form of deviation. If they have to look after the money and they have been sort of deviations like procurement processes and stuff like that, it's on page 20. So it's quite concerning to have National Treasury as well there on some of the deviations. Perhaps they need to explain to us. And then on page 6, page 5, there's some universities there that failed to give the progress reports. Maybe perhaps if the doctor have the names and the list of them, the universities that have failed to give the progress report, so that we can keep them also accountable. I think for now, Chair, it's the only ones that I'm having. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would also join my colleagues in thanking the DDG for the presentations, and also use this opportunity to wish them well in the new year. And I would join my colleagues in, I think, the question that Honorable Zanwile raised would also be relevant with regard to universities, flagging them out which one. But I also would want to add, we would want to know those 29 municipalities. It is important for us to know which of these, and where are they, and what are their issues, so that we can then be able to follow them up. I equally also support the writing of letters to different departments with regard to this under expenditure, because Chairperson, my worry is, what is it, or what is the anticipated risk that we need to foresee? Because we have already started with the fourth quarter. What is the anticipated risk, and what is the mitigating factors that you would have put in place? We don't want to hear at the end of the financial year the stories of a fiscal dumping and being pressured to spend, and those who spend through agencies then dumping the money on those agencies. The other thing, Chairperson, is related to the road accident fund. I just want to find out whether there is any proposal from Treasury on how the road accident fund can really deal with this liability. And I know that during the time of the then Minister Nene, there was a certain, I think it was an 80-cent increase in the fuel levy that actually somehow put a dent to, if that was not done, the liability would have been even worse. It would have actually surpassed Eskom by now. And I would believe that there could be an intervention that is made. I'm raising this because there are many people in our communities, even in our constituencies, who would try and get us to
to help them to get this this money paid, and especially those people who were left in a very debilitating situation, who are in wheelchairs, who need particular types of interventions to be able to recover. I know that money will not actually make you recover from a road crash, but the impact that it has been left, the orphans that has been left by the parents who died in the crash. But I would also, I really appreciate and would support, and I probably ask the members also through their own parties to support the road accident benefit scheme, primarily because of the fact that it is for one an instrument that is going to make it possible for an intervention, in particular the poorest of the poor. The bulk of the road crashes victims are people who probably don't even have, I will make an example of the people of the Moloto corridor. How many of those people were involved in crashes? But because they are ordinary laborers, they are ordinary domestic workers, they were left off worse off than they ever would have been. They end up being a burden, an added burden on SASSA, and yet there could have been some kind of relief through this particular intervention. But also the road accident benefit scheme, being an instrument in this transformation of the social security, system in itself, because of the interventions, I'm sure you would be aware there was the process led by the Department of Labor with the UIF and your COIDAs and all those type of things. So I would really support that type of intervention. With regard to the GFIP and the impact thereof on FANFA, is it not about time that Treasury finalizes this road infrastructure development funding model that would then be able to alleviate the pressures on SANRAL on in an inability to raise monies from the market? Because I would believe that there could be any intervention made. But also the other thing, Chairperson, at one stage we really need to discuss this particular issue of the non-payment culture for services that we are actually inculcating in South Africa. Is it for electricity? Is it for water? Is it for infrastructure that is being built? Where are we driving this country to if people are just going to want to let, like the Basotho would say, just bring on, let me consume, and not do anything to sustain it? We are the very people that complain about potholes. We are the very people that complain about lack of services. And yet, we are the very people that won't want to pay for those particular services. So I want us to be able to say, what is it, even as members of parliament, what is it that we're going to do to inculcate a culture of responsibility? During the early years of Madiba, he launched a Masakane campaign, which was intended to make people pay for services. But right now, we're sitting with municipalities that are collapsing on our watch, primarily because of lack of payment. There are municipalities which, at the end of the month, are unable to pay even salaries. So I think it is important that we look at, through the Treasury's support, some kind of building a culture of payment in South Africa.
Next.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me say a compliment of the service, even though the year is already old.
Not yet old.
So it's still befitting to say compliment of the service. It's still the service, the new year. Let me also join in welcoming Team Treasurer's presentation as led by Dr. Mambu. Chair, today mine is a short question, but Doc, it would demand
a bit lengthy answer. It's deliberate that it be short. On the 26th, Chair, we are going towards the budget day.
I'm raising this because my colleagues in Parliament last year, when they were questioning me around the reasoning behind appropriation, I said the budget day is coming. You remember, Honorable Chover. So my question, it's based on that primarily, that one, going into the new financial year, looking into the current scenario as was projected today in terms of understanding, how do you, or is there a way of reconciliation in terms of your cash flow management strategy going forward, getting into the new financial year, taking into consideration the SONA conjunction, injunctions, the SONA, I would say, strict proposals that have to be implemented vis-a-vis the current picture, taking into consideration what Honorable Matava was saying, that whilst we have to be strict in terms of cash flow management, also we have to avoid the situation where we punish the already punished citizens down there who are currently in the misery. So, do you have a plan? The second one would be, it's a pity, Chair, up until now, I haven't seen these conditions, which are in relation to the appropriations to the SOEs, particularly ESCOM. Allow me to be out of order. You know, gesthosa kukho lento kuthiwa licebe, a spoon. It's only a spoon ethi ngoku iphethwe ibe nayo iphethe. It looks like this issue of ESCOM, it's here. I don't know how to put it in terms of belittling us, particularly as members sitting in this committee. If now we are going to get into Chair, that 26th, I know after the 26th, on the 27th, the minister would be here. But let me tell you, it will be water under the bridge on that particular day, because we will be briefed on what would have already been presented in Parliament. We had said, Doc, we would want to see this condition before that particular day, so that you are able to begin to categorize those conditions. I'm not one person who would always say, if my memory serves me well. I know that my memory is serving me well. I know what I said last year. Because we have to categorize these conditions. Some of those conditions should be by now, as we go towards that budget speech, part of the legislation. Because when you are talking of the budget, you are talking of the bill, you are talking of legislation, and we said some of such conditions should be legislated. That's what we said. And there are some conditions which would be then not necessarily be attached as legislation. You know, we would then categorize them. say, into three parts or so. But now, if we are today in this committee meeting chair, without such tangible information, when else, if not called to rubber stamp, what would already be there? Are we going to continue with the frustration that we endured in the past year? I've said, Chair, yeah, it's a short question, but it would demand more explanation. Thanks, Chair.
Kaiso. Thank you, Honorable Chair and members. Let me start here, Honorable Chair, on the under transport. There is an issue there which says schedules for these grants were, payments of grants were amended, but the department did not adjust their projections to reflect this. You know, sometimes we statements are just being made and left like that, and when they are at this point of the committee, it does suggest that no, nothing will be done, you know, by the other party, just as business as usual. So I want to know what is it that now you're trying to do with this one, because we're singing this song that people just do things and they do not expect anybody to say anything about them. If, for instance, because it's all about service delivery. If the intention is just to put a no reflection on projections and I just submit, nobody will say anything. So I just want to know then what next, because this is not supposed to be the case with the department, not to reflect the projections, and it's a business as usual. Secondly, is on the issue of the issue of we have been talking about this issue, although it was not prioritized. The Treasury did not prioritize it now for as a critical matter to report as seeking attention from the committee, but you just reported under. As normally to say, no, it's progress. But then there is this issue that has been singing as a committee of filling of vacant positions in the department. I'm looking at this program number 5 around skills development. The expenditure was lower than projected, 7.4 million rand, the lower than projected spending was mainly on the compensation of employees and goods and services attributed to delays in filling of vacant funded posts. We can't continue, I think, this trajectory this year, again, singing the issue of filling of vacant posts. In fact, we have put a deadline that Treasury must look into that situation, that all across the department, that all vacant posts must be filled. Maybe we need to get an update as to fast track that in due course. In fact, we have submitted some questions that we're still expecting some response in relation to that. If my memory serves me well, like it served me well, too. So that we can't be continuing talking about filling of vacant posts every month. Every meeting without progress, really, it sends abandon and these things. So we have to close it, it can't just continue as it will come just as a report with no action, no consequent management of it. Chairperson, on small business, yes, would support the call that there has to be a breakdown on this 700 million. This 700 million money given by small business to these other agencies as to their breakdown. Who are those people? What are they doing? Are they producing proudly South African? Are they cooperatives or what? So maybe if we can get an idea at a later stage so that we know actually when we talk about expenditure for our people, poor people, who are we referring to into this transaction? Thank you very much.
Anybody else?
No.
Chair, I forgot one question because I want the doctor to Thomas answer it. There was a one on page 27 on SARS, on short-term staff. Do we want to know which departments within SARS are we using that short-term staff? Because we don't want to repeatedly report on short-term staff, and it seems seemingly they make use each and every time over with short-term staff. So I want to know which departments within SARS is the short-term staff. Maybe it's the ROC unit. We will never know.
Honorable.
Thank you, Chair. It sounds like there won't be another round, so let me quickly add this in. In rural development and land reform, because of the poor spending, monies were allocated through to the land bank. Now you've suspended the land bank. So is that money standing there while land bank is suspended? Please, I'd like you to explain that to us, because you've done that a year or 2 years ago where you created them. And the other problem is this compensation fund for occupational diseases. There's a huge outcry outside there that these people are not paying. For years, people are waiting in the queue. They can't get paid. And I'm not sure if you're aware of that, but I can tell you it's been throughout the media in the last week or 2 weeks. And finally, if you can tell us where's the $1.6 billion I'm looking for, and which I think is supposed to be, I know you're looking at me shocked, but I'm going to tell you why. The $1.6 billion that President has promised that is going to, I think it's going to fall under social development, to fight gender-based violence and things. Please tell me where that money is.
Thank you, honourable members. Thank you, Dr. Mpo. Perhaps before I come to my questions, can we get into the habit of Dr. Mpo? There are some suggestions which will come up from honourable members. For instance, the question of insurance and RAF. Obviously, you may not have an answer to this thing, something that you may have to go and research and so on, and look at pros and cons and so forth. But I think it's important that when you start certain things, we close them, where you come back and say, no, we looked into this, it's doable in this way, or it's not doable because of 1, 2, 3. And when other members ask some of these questions, that they make some of the proposals, we're very much aware that there are some decisions which you may not take and the answer that you may not have at the moment. Perhaps you also need to consult with your colleagues, with the DGs and so on. But I think we should get into the habit of closing issues, right? That's one. I think let's also agree that we need to get the Department of Health to come and engage the committee on the NHI. I think we need that. I would also like us to call the Small Business Development Fund and NEF to come and engage us. I'll tell you why, right? It's well and good to talk about the big numbers, the big institutions and so on, but these are institutions which are supposed to be making impact to the most vulnerable people, right? So we need to know the impact of these things, what exactly is happening. Just saying, honorable members, we need to have that in our schedule. I know that after the budget, it's going to be very hectic, but I think we need to have that. We must call them. On the National Health Laboratories, so we reported they are doing very well and so on, but 2018-2019, I was just being shown by that about half of their budget, right, about 1.6 billion rand, was irregular expenditure, right? So it's well and good to look at the they have spent and so on. But if you have got about 50% of your budget being irregular, it says something. I think we'll need more of a breakdown that exactly is happening there. Dr. Mampo, very early in our life here in this committee, we made a statement that we don't want to be accountants here, where we come and say, here is the budget, here is the year-to-date expenditure, here is the variation, and here is the reason for variation. I think our interest is more about the impact of the happenings or not happenings, for instance, the expenditure and so on. If we don't get that from you, who do we get it from? Because that's very important for us, because we may come here and have a department which will always tell you that, no, I'm within budget, I'm spending, and so on. But as we would all attest, that when you go to the ground, you find that you don't see the impact of the spending when you go to the communities. So the point that we are making is that we would like to get the impact of some of these things, and I'm not very sure where we get it, to get it from you, or we get it from somebody else, but I think to get the full picture, we definitely need to have that. Do you have a view, Doctor, about the different financial years, municipalities and the rest of government? Because it always comes up and you find there's no spending or spending starts late, so on and so forth. If you have a view, do you think this is the most optimal way of dealing with it? Because some of these things, I think it's important that we should confront them. And be scientific in dealing with them. There's a lot of training taking place in government, CITAS, and now there's also this National Skills Fund and so on. What I never get is to really get the return that we are looking for in terms of the skills that one, for instance, are the skills that the economy needs. Do we see the impact of that spending? I'll tell you, I hear so many people who are training this and so on, and you find people, they apply, they go and train, and you find people have been trained on 1, 2, 3, but come the following day, you find those people are sitting idle, and I'm sure those skills, they end up depreciating, and somebody else is going to come and apply to retrain the very people who have been trained on something else. So I'm saying that our training, how relevant is it? Are we getting the social return and economic return that we are looking for? How do we trace those people that now they've been trained? Are they getting the jobs and so on and so forth? Or do we need to find a different way? If I may just think aloud, you know, in dialectical materialism, that's what they call negation of the negation. What that means is that you leave what you don't need, what is old and moribund, but within that there is something positive that you take, you go with. You know, the apartheid government, one of the institutions that they used for training was the state-owned companies. Where, for instance, if you were to go to Transnet, in Transnet, there are all types of engineering, where they are looking at electrical, they are looking at mechanical, they are looking at all this and so on and so forth. Right, where they are looking at accountants, they are all that. Those departments. You name them. The same goes for PRASA. The same goes for ESCOM and so on. Do we ever consider saying to these companies, they are there, say, this is a skills training money that we are giving you, right? These are people who have been trained in an organization, the organization that we are creating, rather than having all these types of trainings that were scattered all over, and the impact is very, very minimal. So I'm saying we have so many of these. You go to CENTEC when it comes to broadcasting again. There's something, there's an institution that we use. So that we look at these institutions as the institutions that before, right, they have been used to train our people. Right? Why don't we use them now and provide and allocate a certain budget to them so that you do this, you make this training, and perhaps you even employ these people, because here's the money that we are giving you, and this ring fence particularly for this thing, rather than this money which has been spread all over, and you never see the impact. I'm thinking aloud. I would like us to consider this, because there's so much training taking place in this country, but you don't see the impact. You don't have even the welders. You don't have plumbers. You end up getting welders, importing welders. If Transnet is going to build the pipeline, they go and import all types of welders. These things used to be done by the vocational schools. After standard 6, people will go and do welding. But now we go and import those kids, but we complain about as not an economy which is not creating jobs. So I'm just saying that I would like a situation where we say, how do we maximize the returns from our state-owned companies, right? Rather than this thing of us assessing the state-owned companies by the bottom line, that they made profit, they didn't make profit, and 101 people are being retrenched, and then we're hit after that they made profit. One such institution is your Telkom. I hear so many people always talk about the success of Telkom, but how many people have been retrenched, and those people become the responsibility of this government, and on the side say, no, Telkom is doing very, very well. But it goes to what measure do we use in measuring the state-owned company, success or not success of the state-owned company. I think that's what it boils down to. The economic measure, or perhaps, they've got they should have a bifocal sort of mandate, developmental and obvious financial. But do we measure the developmental? I don't think so. But I'm just saying, let's look at that. The RAF, Honorable Peters, this is a perennial problem, see? And we employ people, the best of the best, and so on, not us here. By now, I would have expected that there is a solution to this thing. It can't always be year after year we are being confronted by the same thing, but there's no solution. When we employ people to this, for instance, they must come up with a solution. Not us here. Come up with a solution. That's how we're looking at it. The health liability from the provinces, I'm told that it's one of the liabilities which is exploding. How do you get to know about this? Because at the end of the day, it becomes our liability. How do you get to know what is happening there? I'm told the health liability is huge. Talk to that. Again, GFIP, same problem like RAF comrade Peters, kicking the can down the road, always kicking the can down the road. No sustainable solution, right? We are always told, there's this problem. What is the solution? And it's not going to come from us. Can you have the solution, right? That's what we want. We can't be always talking about the same thing. GFIP, paying, not paying. Sandral can't go to the market and raise money. Yes, we know the story. But that's not what we want to hear here. What we want to hear is that, what is the solution? What is the solution? And can we have that, I think, in our next engagement? It may not be coming from Treasury, but coming from the executive. We need to know that. We can't always be dealing with, now it's, I don't know how many years now we're dealing with the very same problem. This thing is either there or not there. And then so that we should know exactly what the solutions are. So I would leave it at that, and then say to the honorable members, now that the chairperson has spoken, that we can take a 10-minute break and have tea, and then we'll come back.
Father, chairperson, father.
The questions are loading.
One very important one. What has happened to your investigation and consequence management on the integrated financial management issue where you have been paying money for no invoices? There was so much of corruption in that process, it's not even completed. Nobody is talking about that. All hush. Number two.
Honorable Chair.
So now we have to say Malibong.
we
thank you, Honorable Chair.
We agree. Usually, Honorable Peters will take a lot of delegations, so you'll find that it is a strong rugby club which comes and represents. So you guys are a breath of fresh air.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Members, Honorable Chair. I'm going to start with some of the more general stuff, and then we'll get into the specifics within my portfolio. So I think one of the things that's quite important to remember in the design of the PFMA, and Minister Manuel wrote this in the foreword in the Green Book when the PFMA was promulgated, and it said it went along the lines of allow managers to hold, to manage, and hold them accountable for their management decisions. So a lot of this, what we're bringing here that we might not be able to answer is really around how do we hold, because in some cases departments accountable for the management decisions that they make. So the management decisions that they make around filling of vacant posts and why vacant posts are empty for that long and why they don't go through the recruitment process is a management decision in departments. And how money gets shifted in their budgets is also a management decision in the departments to deal with some of these things. Honorable Chair, I think one of the important things, and I'm going to go into the specifics around, I mean, dealing with the differences in the financial years for national and national, provincial, and municipal, local government. And part of it is probably a capabilities and a capacity issue within our systems and human resources. I mean, if we had to have all of national government, including public entities and provincial government, with local government on the same financial year, we'd have audits that would need to be happening at the same time for all these institutions. So what is it, 260 municipalities, the 200-odd public entities, the 190-odd provincial departments that we have sitting across provinces, and the 42 departments that sit across national government. And it's purely probably a systems and a capabilities issue on whether the systems can hold that and whether the Auditor General can, within the requirements, the legal requirements that are set out in the PFMA, to audit this. So in the PFMA for national and provincial governments, the Auditor General has 2 months to audit. And if we had to add an additional 200 institutions plus their entities that sits with that, within the legal framework, it makes it really difficult. So part of it is just a capacity and capability issue around when we do this. And if we had to only have the Auditor General audit everybody over a two-month period, what do they do for the rest of the year? And maybe what do we do within our systems for the rest of the year and whether our systems can deal with all of those things? And then on the questions around how do we reconcile what we're doing here with what's coming within the budget, one of the important things that we do as budget analysts is look at spending performance as we make recommendations through the budget process. And it's a very important tool on whether departments have capabilities to spend and how that influences the recommendations that we make. So in what the Minister of Finance will be tabling next week is really a culmination of a whole range of analysis that has been done from a governance, financial management, performance management, service delivery point of view, and that then kind of drives whatever decisions get taken within Cabinet that either is given effect within the State of the Nation address or within the budget speech. So the allocations next week and what we table in the budget next week will be a reflection and take into consideration. So serial underspending within programs will take into consideration where programs are performing and what those priorities are around all of that. So it's not that what we do here is separate from that. It's an important tool. The analysis that we provide here, the reports that we provide to you, is an important internal tool in the Treasury in assessing performance of programs and where we are going, given the plans that has been set up with us, be it in the medium-term strategic framework or the government's annual program of action. And then if I move on to some of the very specific things in my sectors, so let me start with the provincial roads maintenance grant in transport and the projections on both the provincial roads maintenance grant and the public transport network grant. So conditional grants are not only governed in terms of the Appropriation Act and the PFMA, they're also governed by the Division of Revenue Act. And the specific requirements of the Division of Revenue Act on how funds get disbursed, how reporting happens and all of that. So within conditional grants, the Division of Revenue Act requires national transferring officers, so this would be in this case the National Department of Transport, to table it, to provide the National Treasury with a payment schedule on what basis they will be transferring money to provinces and municipalities. That is very different to when departments report to us in terms of the Appropriation Act and the drawing, so the requirements on drawdowns that sits within the Appropriation Act. And the, so it's two, there's two separate systems that should speak to each other. And in the case of the Department of Transport, this time around it didn't. So when they amended the payment schedule, when they requested an amendment to the payment schedule in terms of the Division of Revenue Act, what the department didn't do was in the expenditure reporting system in terms of Section 40 of the PFMA, they didn't amend their projections in there, which is what they should have done. And that's what's caused this mismatch between money being transferred when the payment schedule was amended, but they didn't amend the projections. I mean, we write to departments on a monthly basis raising these concerns, and we ask them to take remedial action. So one of the things that we have specifically flagged around this one with the department is that every time you do this, please make sure that you, every time you need to amend the payment schedule, make sure that your projections are adjusted in your Section 40 PFMA reports so that we don't have this misalignment. Then, okay, let me stay with transport. And maybe let's talk about, Honorable Peters was asking about the road infrastructure funding model. So, I mean, part of the issues around this is really a policy decision that needs to be taken in the Department of Transport. And there's a very technical issue around at what stage do you decide on user charges for roads, and then how do you deal with very important principles within road user charges. So the economic argument around a road is that this is a pure public good, so that you, but as roads become more congested, you're starting to exclude people from it, and that has a cost to the economy, and that's really what you're asking for people to pay, and that's why we have road user charges. So it's the policy choices around all of that that the Department of Transport needs to make. So that's the first component. And the second component within all of that is then what kind of principles are we trying to preserve within the road use charge policy around this? Do we want it to be equitable? So, and I think that's a very important principle, because we don't want lower income travelers to subsidize higher income travelers. If we needed to have some deal with some geographical disparities, we wouldn't want richer provinces like Gauteng to benefit at the expense of poorer provinces like the Eastern Cape and Limpopo. And once you have those kind of principles embedded, then you are able to move with the policy. And I think one of the big things around, so while we have learned a very expensive lesson with GFIP, I mean, I think going forward and the sustainability of our road infrastructure network is dependent on these very important principles that we need to iron out within the road infrastructure funding model. On the road accident fund, and Chair, I'm going to need some indulgence, because maybe we need to just explain some of the background around where we're sitting with the road accident fund and the road accident benefit scheme. So the road accident fund there's fundamental differences between the two systems. So, and I see that the Portfolio Committee on Transport is actually deliberating on the road accident benefit scheme bill as we speak. The road accident fund is a liability insurance scheme, which is fault-based, so you have to find fault. So like in any other insurance scheme, somebody must be found to be at fault, whereas in the road accident benefit scheme, that falls away. And there's an important principle around all of that, because the road accident benefit scheme, as Honorable Peters has mentioned early on, is then based on social security principles, which is a more equitable, more affordable way of dealing with all of this. So the question that Honorable Sheikh had about thinking about private insurance around all of this is really then, it becomes back to an important policy principle that we have within in RADS on whether the system is fault-based or not, and the policy position here is that it won't be a fault-based system. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that the current RADS system is a pay-as-you-go system, which is causing a whole range of liabilities within the road accident fund that it can't deal with. And the uncertainties around all of that, I mean, is partly a broader issue around road traffic management that we have to deal with. Road accidents is, I mean, and when you look at the statistics, half of, what's it, 80%, almost 80% of our road accidents are human error. Is this something that's got to do with training? There's all sorts of principles within road safety that we have to think about, enforcement, the engineering. So, I mean, so drunk driving is an enforcement issue. And how do you deal with that? So part of the problem is that when you have a fault-based system and you don't control the parameters around all of what needs to happen within the system, so and you have to go to court. In some cases, you don't have to because you can accept the offer from RAF. Then it does create this position that the Road Accident Fund finds itself in, that it has absolutely no control over the potential claims that is made against it. And it requires other parts of the system to work really well. What we all pinning our hopes on to fix all of this is the Road Accident Benefit Scheme system, because it's a system that the big policy principle is one that it is based on social security principles. It would allow for more equitable distribution of resources based on social security services and how we align all of that. And that was an important issue that popped up within the Road Accident Fund Commission's report around the RADS or reforming the Road Accident Fund system, is how do you ensure that is a system that is sustainable, that is affordable. And there's two ways that we can look at affordable. How do we ensure that we don't make road accident victims worse off, but we don't also make those who are paying for it, so the road users, any worse off than what they actually are? That the system is equitable, and in that, I mean, that was an important principle in relation to the benefits that you get out of the Road Accident Benefit Scheme system in relation to other social security benefits that sit within the system. So, I mean, so we have lots of work that we've done around what's happening in the Road Accident Fund. The short-term measure with the Road Accident Fund seems to be money, but at what stage does this become unaffordable to the road users? If we had to put another 50 cents or another 70 cents on the fuel levy, what does this mean? Who pays for that, and who does this accrue to, especially when lower-income households drive older cars? So per kilometer traveled, they use more fuel than higher income households who drive fuel-efficient cars. So does this mean the poor is subsidizing the rich? And how do you deal with all of those things within the Road Accident Fund?
But just on that, I would like to get some benchmarking. How do other countries deal with this problem? That's one. And
so only two other countries have a no-fault scheme. Australia, Canada, and New Zealand have no-fault schemes. All the others have liability insurance schemes. So what makes us, I think, a little different to everybody else around having a liability insurance scheme is only 30% of households in South Africa own cars. But so it doesn't. So if you had to do this as a liability insurance scheme on the back of motor vehicle license or third-party insurance, we have a lot of South African road users who don't own cars, so people who use public transport. So how would you then pay for it when 70% of road users don't own the car that they're in? So there's some equity issues around all of that we have to think about. But lots of other countries have a kind of dealing with the common law issue where you go after the wrongdoer, so you sue the wrongdoer. So everybody takes up private insurance or third party insurance, what we would call third party insurance, in case somebody sues them for that. But I think it was a policy decision that we've taken in South Africa, given that most of our road users don't own cars, and it will be very difficult for them to be taking out third-party insurance. How would you also deal with this when it is a taxi driver or a delivery vehicle? Who takes the responsibility around all of that? So it is quite difficult, and there's some complex issues and all of that, and we're happy to write that up for you, Che, on the work that has happened in the evolution of the Road Accident Benefit Scheme.
just to mark time on this one. Remembers, I think again it's one big red flag. I think let's agree that perhaps we need a further engagement on this one, and so on, because it will come back. It's another ESCOM. I think that's what it is, and I don't think we have given it the necessary time and attention. Okay, continue, but you hear what we're trying to say, because as we're saying that year in, year out,
we are having rough, and we seem not to be getting a solution. And I'm also very much reluctant to accept that once we have done with that bill, then there's going to be a panacea. The recent experience with the chief risk officer at ESCOM, we talked about the chief risk officer and so, and we waited for him or her, and he came and so on, and the problems seems to be multiplied. So this thing of something, one thing which will come, and therefore will have all the, will be a panacea of our problems. I'm just saying that when you come with that presentation with RAF itself, would like to see more meat rather than the bit being the expansion. Yes, Honourable.
I think what is very important to be mindful of the fact that this is open to abuse, and as government we are not able to manage this. Finished. I think it's just costing us money and money and money. So I think that should be the most important thing we need to consider. So what do we do? We can't manage it. It's open to abuse. And I don't agree with the issue, to be honest with you, that you know some are going to be paying because not everybody is using. That system will protect everybody that's going to use any form of transport in any case. So I think be mindful of that if you give us together with other countries, so how we can address it. Because I think we need to, you know, I'm confused because certain things, if you can't manage it or not being profitable, you say privatize it. But this particular thing, which is a sore point for us, I believe, and you still give the people the protection, I think we need to consider that to be very seriously. But I think let's give us that, in, you know, a report on, in terms of that, and then we could see. Because on the ground, people are complaining bitterly, and you are correct. The money is not even being made by the poor man. It is the lawyers that are making all this money. They're running a scam. Same thing with medical claims, exactly the same thing.
Thank you, sir, for that.
Just one more thing that I wanted to mention about the Road Accident Fund, and the new management has acutely acknowledged this, is that one of the ways to probably deal with the growth in the liabilities in the Road Accident Fund is probably to review the administrative system and at what stage they make an offer. A lot of the times when you are spending lots of money on lawyers and all of that, it's because there's an issue with both the internal and the external counsel on how they process the claim. So within the claims administration, and there's anecdotal evidence that suggests that the way the Road Accident Fund deals with its claims process isn't the way other insurance schemes or liability insurance schemes deal with it. So in the same way, when you claim from your own insurance for something and the investigations that happen within all of that, that might not necessarily be the case within the Road Accident Fund. That leads to all sorts of inefficiencies in how payments are made, who payments are made to, and to what extent those payments are made. On PRASA... Okay, so PRASA faces a very unique position where it runs massive operating deficits. So PRASA runs its operations at a loss, yet it is unable to spend its capital budget. So it's sitting on lots of cash because it's not able to spend its capital budget. And that's the difficulty within PRASA, is that you need to make the capital investments to run a reliable service. And you have a system that is more or less inefficient, that is a drain on your operations. So PRASA runs operating deficits. So from the numbers that we showed you in the presentation, so PRASA has its cash flows from operations is a negative position at the end of the second quarter of about 1.2 billion. But its cash that it's sitting on at the end of the quarter was about 18 billion rand, and that's just because it's unable to spend its capital budget. And part of the problem that exists within PRASA is probably reviewing the entire operating model. What is critical about, is when you're running aging infrastructure in the way that PRASA is running it, is that we have to get the CapEx program going again. If it is a problem of capabilities within PRASA, the recent decisions taken by the Minister of Transport around governance within PRASA, we're hoping will start turning things around, and we're starting to, we'll rejig the capital program in a way that it will start services again. So like the President said in the State of the Nation last week, PRASA has closed down the central line here in Cape Town. They've closed down the Mabopane line. I'm told that the line between Joburg and Pretoria is also not operational. And it's really PRASA saying that we have to fix the CapEx, we have to secure the line, get everything working there so that we can run a reliable service. And that's the difficulty around all of this. If you're running deficits on a quarterly basis of 1.2 billion rand, that money has to come from somewhere. But its fair revenue number has declined. Its fair revenue has declined. Fare evasion is at record highs. Passenger numbers are declining. And you need to make the critical capital investments to get that running again. And that's the difficulty that that disability has. Is it a human resource issue? I don't know. I suppose we're going to have to ask the CASA to answer that. So this is again one where it's a management decision, and we have to hold managers accountable for the decisions that they make.
Perhaps it will not only be focusing on CASA, but generic, but it just came into my mind now. Do you, as the team treasury, participate in these various strategy planning sessions, be it of the various departments or even this SOE, wherein you begin to infuse your thinking as you are now raising at that point in time?
That's all dependent on whether we ask to do it. So at the request, so I mean, some departments will invite the Treasury to the strategic planning sessions just as an observer. Sure. Others will ask the department to make the Treasury to make an input. And we take our guidance from the departments and entities on whether they want us there or not, whether they want us to input or not. I mean, we're always happy to input, but it's really there's no hard and fast rule around all of that.
Safe to say that well, in PRASA you're always having a board member coming from National Treasury and coming from the Department of Transport, and supposed to, at least amongst other things, offer that type of and expertise as a board member. But continue.
So I'm going to move on to human settlement.
Yeah, okay.
Sorry,
okay.
You were saying?
No, I was saying, Chair, the answer she gave suffice for us to note so that we can see how best to escalate our thinking.
So I'm going to move on to human settlement. And the withholding on the USDG and the HSDG. So on the USDG. So in November, the department was held for like persistent underspending. I mean, so this is municipalities who had only spent at the end of November or the beginning of November about less than 25% of what was transferred to them from the national department, and that is their department viewed as significant underspending. So, and that was four cities. It was the city of Cape Town, Tshwane, Ekurhuleni, and Mangaung. So what the department did was they asked each of the cities to write them a recovery plan, and if they got the recovery plan and they were happy with the recovery plan, the money was then transferred in December. The money was transferred for the city of Cape Town. The money was transferred. They were partially happy with the money from the recovery plan from Ekurhuleni, so it was transferred to Ekurhuleni. Or 81% was transferred to Ekurhuleni, and they hadn't received, so the National Department had not received recovery plans from the city of Tshwane and from the city of Mangaung, and that is why they withheld the money. So there was persistent underspending within those municipalities. The municipality wasn't able to give them reasons on how they're going to, or give them sufficient comfort that they were able to recover from all of this, and then the department withheld the money. So that was on the USDG.
Sorry, Chair, just a follow-up there. Do you have a breakdown of how much they've underspent in this particular year?
I do.
On each one. Can you just give me that? Thank you, Chair.
So at the end of... The underspending in the city of Cape Town versus against the transfer was 255 million. In Tshwane was 240 million. In Ekurhuleni was 301 million. And in Mangaung was 122 million. That was 75% underspending for Mangaung. So even though it's a smaller amount, it was a larger percentage of what was transferred. So as a result of that, at the end of the third quarter, 503 million was withheld from Tshwane, 120 million was withheld from Ekurhuleni, and 382 million was withheld from Mangaung. And then, so The last issue, okay, so there's two more issues that I need to deal with. So the second last issue is on
Is there any way you could give us through the chair for the last financial year what was the total underspending by these particular municipalities? I think we're trying to get a picture of it.
Okay, even if you can just write down to and bring it to us so that we can circulate.
We'll have to, because I don't have that information.
Yeah,
so
okay.
I'll have to do that. So let me move on. So with the Department of Cooperative Governance and the withholding of the equitable share, I mean, this is a difficult one, and we think of it as an important reform in trying to instill financial management discipline within municipalities. And if you want to get the payment culture right and all sorts of things, it's about getting municipalities to table credible budgets. It's getting municipalities to table funded budgets, because there's no point in tabling a budget that you can't execute because you don't have the resources to do that. I mean, we really think of this as a win in changing the behavior within municipalities and how they budget around all of this. The 29 municipalities that, I mean, I do have the list of the 29 municipalities in front of me, and I don't know if it's worth mentioning because it's a lot. But what I think is quite important about this list is that the 29 municipalities at the end of December, all we asked them to do was to show us positive cash balances at the end of December. 28 municipalities were able to show that in January. So one municipality that wasn't able to show that, unfortunately, is one of the metros that we withheld the USDG from, was Mangaung. So in January, when we got those positive cash balances, those 28 municipalities got the money, and it was just the 29th municipality, which was Mangaung, that didn't get its money. I'm happy to also share the list of those municipalities with the committee that was withheld in December, even though the money was transferred in January around all of this. And then the last thing that deals with me, which was indirectly related to PRASA, the Road Accident Fund, was around fuel volume sold. So the Central Energy Fund publishes information around this. So I'm thinking about, so in the comment that's in the presentation around how the Road Accident Fund gets its money. So the Central Energy Fund publishes by magisterial district on its website how much is sold. One of the things that you'll see within the long run trends around this is because of an energy efficiency and engines becoming a lot more fuel efficient and all of that, is a long-run decline in energy sold, in fuel, both diesel and petrol. So the diesel numbers are slightly skewed by the Eskom running its open-cycle turbines off diesel, but in a long-run decline, so we always say that the fuel levy isn't a buoyant revenue source because of the long-run decline in fuel sales. And so that is one, because of energy efficiency. The other one is that fuel sales is also just a function of travel demand, which is a function of how active the economy is. If people don't have jobs, they don't travel to work. If factories are not running, they don't have trucks bringing in supplies, they don't have products going out. And as that demand declines and adjusts across the business cycle, you also see that that's what happens to fuel sales. But that information is available. I mean, the Department of Energy is quite good with putting out the information, and the Central Energy Fund is quite good with putting that information out on a timely basis. Thank you, Chair. That's all from me.
Okay, thanks, Mampo, and thanks, Chair. And good afternoon, honorable members. My questions will focus on, I mean, I'll respond to questions on NHLS and SASA and medical years. On NHLS, you ask whether there are any provinces that have not paid or that have paid higher amount. The issue here is where we are generally happy with performance of NHLS this time, because it's emerging from a period where they were not able to manage their cash very well, and primarily because provinces were not paying their accounts and because there was a dispute with provinces. So that part of dispute has been resolved, so provinces are paying as required. The difference for this quarter is that Gauteng paid much more than it was expected for quarter two. They paid the 150 million, so they've held it for a longer term rather than what was expected in December. So that made their books turned their books into a more positive side. You also asked a question around, I think that was all about NHLS. Then the second issue as on medical legal is how do we get to know how much we are paying and what is the plan going forward. For 2018-19, we know that the medical legal claim reached about 2 billion rand bill, and the Department of Health is engaged in several measures to try and address it, and some of them include this partnership that they have to engage with CPSA and state lawyers to try and manage leakages in general. But from the department's side, the problem is approached from a multifaceted angle, because part of the problem is that you have inadequate records and inadequate quality of care, which is the basis for people having to have claims against the health system. So we're working on that. One of the plans that the department will be working on in the coming financial year is the National Health Quality Improvement Plan. One of the plans that the department will be implementing in the coming financial year, and they may even be able to start it earlier, is the National Health Quality Improvement Plan, which is hoped to improve service quality and manage the number of incidents that lead to medical aid claims. The other part of the intervention that they have is what they call the State Liability Amendment Bill, which is sitting with Parliament for consideration. That is part of the response to try and manage medical legal claims and growing medical legal bills.
This 2 billion rand you're talking about on those medical legal claims, my understanding is it excludes the legal costs of our legal costs, the state's legal costs. Do you have an idea what is the legal cost to deal with this 2 billion rand claim, anyway, that it is also costing us? Because we need to get a better picture of exactly what it is costing us.
Definitely, it excludes our legal costs. It only includes claims that have been paid. I don't have the exact number of how much it costs us as the Department of Health and the state lawyers, who will look into that and will give you feedback. Thank you. On the issue around FASA, the question asked was about whether the reconciliation of claims was part of the agreement between FASA and SAPO. And the answer is yes. That's precisely why FASA is withholding payment to SAPO at this stage, because SAPO has not been able to provide reconciliation for a number of months. We had a discussion yesterday with FASA and SAPO. Both entities and their respective departments were asked to look into the issue and see how this can be resolved to enable FASA to be able to pay SAPO what is due to them. The other question we have relates to the 1.6 billion on the fight against gender-based violence and femicide. This is a little tricky, because what we had was the emergency response that came to Parliament while the cycle for E&E was about to close. But that was mid-year, and department have had to respond to address gender-based violence as per request, as per from the committee and by the president. So the 1.6 billion entails a variety of measures in departments that primarily were in the baseline or were shifted from departments to try and shifted within departments to try and respond to the crisis of gender-based violence. So it was not a new allocation. It was just allocation that is intended to respond to measures relating to gender, to addressing gender-based violence. That will include responses such as sexual offences code that was already budgeted within the Department of Justice. It will include measures such as social worker appointments that within the Department of Social Development. So it's not necessarily a new allocation. And reporting on this amount will be reflected when department reports on their expenditure and indicates how they spent what they had allocated at the beginning of the year.
I think I didn't get a response on the NHI issue, but let me just come back here. If you talk about we shifted monies, we reallocated from some, so what is the impact of those departments that you are basically taking away? Because obviously all these different departments, when you talk about sex offences, all of them have had an allocation and whatever it is. But I think what the president was specifically saying here is to allocate this, and yes, I don't think it's an amount that needs to be used overnight or whatever it is. It's a process that we need to, you know, with the intervention. But I tell you, the picture we're trying to get is that with the announcement by the president, has there been any initiatives that have already been introduced, and what is the cost implications of that? Because we want to measure that with the feedback as to the progress we've made on the ground in terms of dealing particularly with the issue of that gender-based violence.
Yes, before you answer, Tip, I think it's an important explanation which the public must also understand, because GBV is a big issue there. People are going to say tomorrow, there's a 1.6 billion rand that was announced by the president. What is it doing? That's that. So your explanation that, well, this 1.6 billion is all over in all the departments and so on. But it's also very important, if that's what you are then saying, it's important is how do we measure the success or failure of that allocation. Like, remember what I said to you, that we are not accountants. We want to say, okay, we've put aside, in whatever way, 1.6 billion rand for GBV. What has been the impact? Are we able to measure that and so on? So that when we go back and report to our people that, yeah, this 1.6 billion, that's what it has done and so on, rather than coming up with this figure and find that there is no way that we are tracking its success or failure, so to speak. I'm sure you get my drift.
Okay. Mampo, you want to the first one? Okay.
Let me back you up.
Mm-hmm.
So, Chairperson and Honorable Members, when the President announced, the Department of Women wrote a proposal on how these funds will have to be spent. So when we looked at the proposal and they brought it to the Treasury, we said to the Department, okay, apart from the commission that you want to set up, most of these functions already exist within the different departments. We had a consolidated meeting where we sat with the department to try and iron out what is it that needs to be done. So for example, police, you have to do the red kits, are they sufficient, are they enough, do you need to move funds to deal with the service you need to provide. So the departments move funds within their own functions to try and deal with this. Then you have a department such as social development that didn't even have gender-based violent functions in them. They move money from SASA, where there was underspending, they allocated it to the function. So what the department has done is that from the proposals of what needs to be done, they monitor whether the departments are spending towards what they are proposing in the plan. So the Department of Women would be the people that monitor other departments' interventions in terms of gender-based violence. So you can measure. The good thing was that, Honorable Members and Chairperson, is that what we figured was the total amount that is directed for gender-based violence is more than the 1.6 billion, but it's hidden everywhere in the system. So the Department of Women has to take it out of and lift it up so that it's easy for them to say this is what has been done by the different departments. The whole point which makes this 1.6 billion difficult is that it's not a fund, it's a function. And the department is too small to perform that function. Therefore, the different departments have to perform the function, but they remain responsible in monitoring whether the other departments have done so. What we have done also as the Treasury was also to look at when we do the budgeting and we're engaging with the different departments in the budget process, how is it or where are they shifting the funds to deal with the gender-based violence? So most of this you will find, Chairperson, that, or Honorable Member, that it would be in the report back by the Department of Women. We did allocate about 50 million for the, it's not a commission, it's the council. So the council has been established that would look at what is it that needs to be done, and all of these should be put in the performance or APPs of the different departments so that they can implement. But the money is in the system and it's not a fund. I think if the president announced the fund, it would be easy to say this is 1.6 billion, it was allocated to that department and that department. But if it's already in the system, it's difficult to lift it up. But they are the responsible people to make sure that the departments do what they say they do in terms of gender-based violence. I hope that answers the question.
Thank you, Chair. I'm sorry. There was a proposal, you say, from the Women Department of Women. In fact, I think this committee needs that proposal because we need to follow it up and chase it and see where the implementation. That's the first thing. Second thing is we agree there is no new amount that is going to be decided. It's going to come from somewhere. The question is, what impact is it going to have on already those departments that you're taking it in? Now, let me, you gave one good example of rape kits. Now, I'm not in agreement with that. Because SAPS has already been received an allocation for rape kits in every police station throughout the country. Now, if you're giving them additional, it means that the monies that were allocated previously for their rape kits and things, they have not basically, because a lot of the police stations didn't have it. They need to explain why didn't have it. Now, you're taking money and giving them again for something that we've already allocated and which they haven't spent on. So you see the difficulty that we're basically having there. And let me tell you that, you know, I'm part of that committee, and I think some of my colleagues, and we went to it. Yeah? They couldn't even, believe me, provide us, each one of us, with exactly the same document so we could follow it. That is how bad it was. So we don't know where it is going and what it is, but I can tell you the feedback from the ground, there has been no impact whatsoever. In fact, it's become worse. So that is why we are concerned, and we want to know where you took it from. How is it impacting on those departments? Where is it going? Should it go to SEPs, like I'm giving you a rape kit as an example, because they already have the allocation. They should have ensured there are rape kits there. Otherwise, all these departments are not going to do. You're going to give them additional money for those things coming from there. So what are they doing with those budgets that were allocated to them for this? That's our concern.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Member. As Dr. Mampo has said, 1.6 billion was not new money, so it's not an additional allocation for police. But if the resources that are, I mean, except for the bid that was from social development that they had to shift from SASA to GBV response measures, if part of the allocation that was already in the baseline to respond to gender-based violence-related issues. So the rape kits in police, in the Department of Police, will be part of the 1.6 billion. Where they feel they have a gap to invest in around forensic issues, then they could shift resources from another area and prioritize forensics. The sexual offenses court that were already in the plan of the Department of Justice will be part of the 1.6 billion as well. And in provinces, some of the premier's office has decided to introduce different interventions from special projects or from other programs that they shifted resources. Some of the departments and provinces will look at areas where they expect, anticipate possible underspending and immediately shift those resources towards gender-based violence responses. And the shift happens within the department. So we haven't had a shift that moved from one department to the other. So it's still resources that are within a specific department. Currently, the committee that is sitting at the interim steering committee that is responsible for the plan is requesting department to report regularly on this measure, both the spending and the interventions. The problem with regular reporting is it tells you about activities, not so much about the impact. So our sense is you'll probably be able to have a better sense in terms of the quality of intervention, the change it may have made, perhaps at the end of the year. This was a six-month plan. But this 1.6 billion also includes allocations from the beginning of the year. So this 1.6 billion is for the whole year, from April to March 2018, I mean 2019-20 financial year.
Okay, continue.
And thanks. Maybe on the NHI,
I just wanted to say, guys, you have got 15 minutes to finish your response.
Okay, sorry. On the initiative, we thought we'll get the response from the National Department of Health. They agreed with the chair's proposal that it would be better to invite them so they can explain properly to the committee what they do.
Okay. I'm checking if you covered everything. Just addition on the NHI, honorable members, the Treasury has written a finance paper and looked at the possible options on how we can implement this, because one has to look at the intergovernmental issues between who the functions, who performs which function, and also given the fact that there's no money, well, there is money in the system, but the NHI was not budgeted for, how can we implement it in a scale that is affordable over a long-term period. So we're hoping that we can publish the paper with the budget review, but this is still under discussion with our minister, but the finance paper exists. So if the minister signs off and says we can publish it, when the committee calls the Department of Health, Treasury can come also and present the finance paper that would have been published, but we have worked on the finance paper for the NHI. Okay, so let me finish off the rest of the questions.
That's the last intervention.
Okay, sorry to do. Our concern is not just with the issue of the financing. Our concern is the success of the implementation of the NHI. So your open paper, and I don't know at what stage we're going to be getting that as well, your proposal, but we need to look at it because we need to be realistic whether we're going to be successfully able to implement it. And that's where our concern is.
The reason why I'm saying we should bring it up is because we don't want the department to say Treasury is not funding it, therefore it won't be successful. We want the public to know these are the finance options that are available for us to implement this. But point taken, we will be with the Department of Health if the minister signs off on the paper.
Sorry, Chair. You've got a proposal on in terms of the funding, but how do you give a proposal on a funding when you really don't understand fully and based on the circumstances and the challenges we're facing at the moment in the department on the ground and things? How do you have a proposal in terms of funding if you don't really know exactly what is required to make a success of that? That is what my concern is, and I know you don't know, because none of us here really know fully where this thing is going to in terms of, we know it, we want to implement a brilliant idea, it must happen. We are concerned because we don't want it to fail. We want it to be a success from day one. That's the thing. So I think you're going to need to get the department to be realistic, the Department of Health. These are all the concerns, and maybe you should be, before you even get to the minister, you deal with the department and on the ground and your provinces everywhere. What are the challenges? Because otherwise you're going to allocate the money, they're not going to be able to implement it successfully, and that's it, the money's going to go away.
Okay. Point taken. I was going to go back to the history, but now I have 10 minutes left now, or probably 5. But we have been working with the department. They will come and present. On the questions of the vacant post and scarce skills and critical skills, there's been 2 departments that wrote to the National Treasury asking for secondments because of the national macro reorganization of the state. So what we're figuring out now is that the department, we're starting to look for skills within the state so that we can mobilize the skills better. So even if there's no, they're struggling to fill up critical posts and they can't find them outside, the departments are already asking other departments to assist them with filling up critical posts, whether on a permanent basis or on a contact basis. So I think that's a very good development within the state. So we've gotten 2 responses. I looked at the salary and they said you move with your own salary, so it just killed my interest. But I'm sure for other people whose salaries are lower, they will jump for the opportunity, but there is inter-movement of the skills within the state. And the SARS, I was very happy when I read that the short term on critical matters rather than anything else. So what they do is, if it's the e-filing season, they have short-term people to assist with those. If there's border post peak times like Christmas and all of that, they have the short-term people there. And then while there's still e-filing, there's still a lot of people that bring hard copy forms. So during the peak time, they will be processing those forms, and they also include short-term staff for call centers during peak time. The other unit was not mentioned on the WhatsApp. And then the list of universities that they didn't complete the forms, basically it was the Valley University, Nelson Mandela Bay University, Northwest University, Sifako Mokgatho University, and the University of Limpopo. So those are the five universities that the department is dealing with. But as I said, they are helping them complete the forms, and when we come in the fourth quarter, we think the funds will be transferred. So that's what they're working on.
Doc, I didn't get all of them. After, can I just have that list of
We will send it. So I will list everything that we're going to send, and then the secretariat will have
perfect.
It. So I'll definitely do that.
Doesn't inspire confidence if the universities are going to be helped to fill in forms and so on and so forth. What do they teach our kids?
Chairperson, but to be fair on them, they're new to the process. So some of them are new to the process, so we're just helping them. And then after that, the following year, we don't expect the same problems. If we do expect the same, if we get the same problems, then we worry.
No, Ted will hold you to that.
Chairperson, on why the National Treasury is on the presentation list. So what we do is that I present the summary of the ones that I think the committee should look at, and there's red flags. But the rest of the votes will be in the presentation, where we're just looking at their detailed spending according to economic classification programs. So if you look at my presentation where I stop, for the rest of the 58 slides, it will be just all the votes that we present to you. So we don't, the PFMA requires that we report per vote. That's why our report is so thick. So even the presentation, we think it's easier for you to look at the presentation and then go to the report rather than just us giving you the report. So all of the departments will be there, but in the summary, in the presentation summary, I'll present the ones that I think needs to be highlighted. I'm very encouraged that you went through the rest of the presentation. And then, Chairperson, the the fund, Julius Fund, the compensation fund. the comp fund. Honorable member, you are right. So the reason why they spent more than what they think they were going to spend was because they're now dealing with the backlog. So it is true that they were not processing claims fast enough. So now they've started to pay the backlogs. I think what we're going to do is to look at how big the backlogs are, the amount, and how fast they're processing the backlogs. But they have started. If you look at the slide, it does show that they're spending more than what they said they will because of the processing of these of this funds. Then, Chairperson and Honorable Members, we came a couple of times and we explained that the function to monitor the money to the end was moved to the Department of Performance Monitoring and Evaluation. However, Treasury doesn't just say, because the function has been moved, we no longer follow the money. So we use other mechanisms to try and force the departments to report to us. So, for example, the conditions in the Small Business Fund says you will report on progress on who you disperse the funds to, and the allocations for future years to this fund will be dependent on your performance on the current disbursements. So if they want additional funding for the next year, they will have to adhere to the conditions. But I take that we need to bring the Small Business Department here to explain. What we worry about, Honorable Members, is that if you transfer the money to an entity, in our books, because of how we record it, it is recorded as money has already been spent.
if we stop there, then it means we will never know if the the normal person or the small business got the funds. So putting conditions in these allocations assists us in monitoring this. But I take that we will need to bring the Department of Small Business here. Chairperson, on your comment on training across the government, I agree with you. We're starting to look at reviews on with the Department of COCTA and other departments on the CWP, Community Works Program, and its implications, but also the EPWP to see what happens to these people. Are these training programs useful and are they helping us? But I take your point, and I'm not sure how we can ask the SOCs to incorporate the training as part of their programs. I mean, the last response we got was that they have interns, but their biggest worry is that if they take X number of interns, the unions expect them to absorb all of these interns. So it becomes difficult for them to train more than what they can afford in the system. But I think a conversation on how we add this should help. And most of these SOCs, Chairperson, they have a developmental mandate as part of the portfolio. So in that developmental mandate, we need to add a portion of training. And I think it's a conversation that I will have with my colleagues when I go back to the Treasury, the ones that are responsible for monitoring the SOCs. So, Chairperson, in... Oh.
Yeah, on that, the biggest problem would have been us expecting them to train without them having funds for that. And once you budget for them to give them funds specific for this training and so on, and for incubators of some sort, and you fund that, right? You know, the YES program that the president spoke about is mainly about the private sector. But let's not outsource everything. We can do some of these things ourselves, right? We can do ourselves, and as long as you fund that mandate and you don't get new money, I'm telling you there's so much training money, it just makes me mad because I don't see the impact of that, right? So I'm saying if you were to go to these SOCs, and you agree we're funding this, you follow up and so on. That's it. And when they get out of that, you find that the market will be wanting them because there will be proper training. By the way, let me tell you, there are a lot of these private companies who claim all sorts of money about training young black people, and they don't train them. They just, if there's some incentives they get, they claim on those incentives, and those kids are up and down taking papers from one office to the other, and after that period, nothing goes there. So I'm just saying, let's also look at let's have that conversation, and especially again with those departments which have got a lot of these SOCs, DPE, Department of Transport, amongst others.
And then I must say, Chairperson and honourable members, in this committee, Treasury has to work, because I'm looking at the list of things I must do after this meeting. So the meeting doesn't end now. Usually after I must go and work.
Yeah.
So this is the list in summary of what it is required from the committee. We need to add the South African Post Office into the list of SOCs that we report as the National Treasury. We need to ask SARS to submit the IT report and the progress and why they need the money over the MTF. The small business at the year end, they must report on how they spent the $700 million and the list of the small businesses that they gave the money to. And then we need to provide a list of municipalities as committed by Ulrika. I will also resubmit the list of universities that they have underspent. I will also check if it's possible to see how much of the grant money they haven't received, but I'll check with the team and we can add that information there. And then I need to also check, Darren, as I said, I asked the team to send the conditions of the SOCs. I must just follow up if they did. And then Ulrika needs to do the write-up on the road accident fund and comparing the countries. And then Bebeze has to look at the legal cost associated with the medical legal, not the 2 billion, but the cost of it. And I need to find the proposals by the Department of Women on the gender-based violence.
There's two very important things that were left out. One is the one on the land bank, where because of the poor spending, the monies were transferred to land bank, and now that you've suspended land bank, is the money now sitting in land bank? That's
what does suspend mean?
I'll give you the item that I want to go. That's the one. Okay. The second thing I think is very important. I think one of our colleagues spoke about the conditions of ESCOM on the release of those monies. Have they met those conditions? I think that. And then finally, Chair, don't forget that we also want a full report through your DGs and things on that integrated financial.
Oh yes, I forgot that one.
Very important.
It was not intentional.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, honourable members. To your question, honourable member, around the blended finance, maybe if I may give the brief background for the benefit of the members in terms of how the blended finance originated. It was introduced in 2017. It was capitalized out of ACAS and the RECAP program with an amount of about 370 million in 2017. It was meant to address the shortcomings that were identified in CAS and RECAP, mainly because there were some farmers that were double benefiting from government incentives on agriculture, and also to make sure that the groups that the private sector financial intermediaries were not ready to fund, they can bridge that investment gap in the sector. Hence, the blended finance was introduced in 2017. So, mainly for small holder farmers and emerging farmers, particularly the black farmers, who are already in the farming business, but now they want to progress in terms of commercializing their farmers. So the blended finance was mainly introduced for that purpose. But as it was rolled out, there were limitations along the way. There were some challenges and some concerns. Nonetheless, in 2019, it was further recapitalized with an amount of 3.9 billion over the 2019 MTF period. But as the rollout process was going, Treasury was called to Parliament in March 2019 to come and make a presentation around the challenges and how we intend to address those challenges. Challenges around allegations that some of the companies were fronting within the blended finance, and also the allegations that, or particularly the criticism around the criteria that was developed by the land bank in terms of not having a limit on how much it can disperse to a farmer. So it means that one farmer could get as much as possible. So that will crowd out other farmers that are also eligible for the scheme. And the issue of making sure that how do you make the sector sustainable. So based on those concerns, the fund was suspended, and that called for the review of the blended finance by the Department of Agriculture, Rural Development, and Land Reform, together with the Land Bank. The Land Bank is still an implementing agency. The money is still within their coffers, but they can't implement until the challenges have been resolved. One of the areas that they needed to resolve was to make sure that the roles and responsibilities of these three stakeholders are clear. Everybody within knows what to do, who does what. And also to make sure that the land bank in their criteria, because the application process was criticized to be cumbersome. Some of the farmers that are eligible who want to apply, they end up giving up because of the cumbersome of the process. And also the fact that the program in some instances, it's not known to farmers, especially the smallholder farmers, that this fund is tied again. So there's no publicity around this program. So the review process meant to address those things and also to make sure that there's sufficient stakeholder consultative process that is taking place. So the process in terms of consultation has happened. So Department of Agriculture has presented a draft agreement to the National Treasury last year sometime in November to make sure that you are on board to agree that this is it sort of contains the best practices and it will make sure that there's effective implementation of the blended finance. We are hoping that before the end of the financial year, the program will kick start again, will be rolled out. But the money is still with the blended, is still with the land bank. Yes, and the land bank is still the implementing agency. Thank you.
I'm very conversant with that, Very, very conversant with it. I don't understand why programs should be stopped when people are reviewing things. This thing has been stopped for more than a year and farmers are not getting it. Let me tell you where it comes from. It comes from the land bank. The land bank was criticized that it's not lending to black farmers. Right? That's the main thing. And the land bank's response was, that's definitely a developmental mandate. Right? And National Treasury doesn't give us a cent to deal with developmental mandate. All the money that we have, we get it from the market. Right? There was also a complaint about the rates that are being paid by small farmers. And then bank was saying, we can't charge less because we must still repay the money, and people who lend us money, they also want to see a return on that money. So that money became expensive. Right? Hence, the Department of Agriculture started to come in and lend when there were still two different departments. You see, that's the money that we are having, right? And then hence blended. Blended finance means there's a loan and there's also a grant. Supposing, for instance, you are going to borrow 100 rand to try and de-risk the project. Right? Land Bank was saying, okay, we're going to give you 20 rand as a grant and then loan. I'm making an example. I don't know what the percentages were. But at the heart of this thing, right, is that thing that you make it blended, try to de-risk the project, make it the ability of the farmer, enhance the ability of the farmer to repay back the money, because it was very clear that most of the farmers were not able to repay the money and so on, and a lot of bad debts, so to speak. So my contention with all this thing, all programs and everything you review, right, whether this Mercedes-Benz is still the good Mercedes, we don't stop all the Mercedes-Benz which are out there and say we're going to be coming up with a better Mercedes-Benz next year. Right? You don't do that. You know? But I'll also tell you that this thing has been caught in the politics of the departments, because if there's money, the department versus the land bank. Right? And then this thing was stopped and so on. The ultimate beneficiaries are suffering about this thing. And this thing, they take years, people reviewing. Why must this thing take forever when the farmers are getting assistance? People are reviewing and so on. It's one meeting after the other and everybody, because at the end of the day, people want to have a control over this blended finance thing. And so I'm saying this thing came from the land bank. I think the department, you as National Treasurer, that's my view, right? You need to, because you want to give land bank a developmental mandate and say this is the mandate that we are giving you to deal with this thing, right? So that this thing doesn't get so, it's so messed up, I'm telling you. It's so messed up because there are so many interests which can't be reconciled, who's going to control this. Even in the department, you find that different sections and so on, and they want to deal with this thing. So as I'm saying to you, there's a developmental mandate that we are giving to the land bank, right? You want to encourage them to also lend to the emerging farmers, because the write-offs, as you'll see, for emerging farmers is too high and so on and so forth. So I would like you to get over to that process. And this reviewing, the forever reviewing process, is not helping us. It's more than a year now that things under review, am I right?
The review started last year.
Yeah. So we're going for a year now. Yeah. So I'm correct and everything stopped. But that's fine. You hear what I'm saying? You hear what I'm saying? And we need to get some where you directly deal with this thing. The departments have got many other responsibilities. No expertise in terms of dealing with funding. You've got most of the people in the department are mainly are the experts on agriculture, not on funding.
Perhaps I may need to emphasize that the capitalization of the blended finance, like you said, is a grant loan funding. So the grant portion came from government, particularly the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Land Reform. And the loan funding, it was the land bank that was galvanizing funding from private sector, and not necessarily from the balance sheet of the land bank.
Okay, Honorable Shin.
Yeah, very quickly, Chair, you said something very important and concerned, where there were those farmers that were double benefiting over and above a blanket funding. Could you take us into conference and tell us that in terms of the people applying for those fundings and whatever it is there any way in those documents where they have to declare where else they're getting? Because I'm trying to find out whether there's been an act of fraud committed here for people to get additional benefit or double benefits and things like the expense of others. And including the fronting. So I don't know if you could just tell us there whether you think those people that have double benefited had deliberately misled in being able to get, you know, resources from, you know, different.
If you don't have an answer, say so. don't think.
I don't have an answer, but that was a concern that was raised by the Department of Agriculture, and hence the money was redirected from the CAS, where there was, you know, the visibility of double benefiting towards the blended finance, because through the blended finance, there was going to be a checking system to make sure that there's no double benefiting in the blended finance scheme.
Okay, let's continue. Mampo and Lebo, I think I should have a one-on-one with you.
Okay.
Yeah, we need to talk about this. And then because this committee would need a response going forward, what exactly is happening with that blended finance, where are we now and so on, when is it starting?
Chairperson, may I, if you allow, the issue of the blended finance, when you said that it looks like there's a certain grouping that is benefiting from this scheme, which is not necessarily known to people who are supposed to be benefiting from it. Most of the applications, because the blended finance is supposed to benefit existing smallholder farmers with a turnover for around 500 million per annum. But most of the applications were 500,000, sorry. Thank you for correcting me. 500,000. But most of the applications were new farmers. And one of the areas that the Department of Agriculture is trying to address is to make sure that it is because of most of the interest is coming from the new farmers that do not necessarily have that turnover that is being required. So how do we make sure that, you know, the blended finance, it also doesn't crowd out those new farmers that also, that sort of reflect the potential to grow?
That's fine. We're done. Okay, honourable members, that takes us to, I think, to the end of the presentation and our engagement. You have identified those issues that you said so that we don't allow things to fall into the crevices. We must have a day where you don't tell us anything else, where you come and report on these specifics which have been raised here, that's what has happened. If you need to come with a particular department, so be it. I think between yourself and the secretary, go and prepare and so on, get this information, and then we get a date where we are not going to talk about anything else, so that you don't keep on hearing new things and without closing the things that were spoken about. So I would like us to have that. I know that it's
certainly so deals with the SOCs, am I right? So from National Treasure. If there are things coming from there which you think that falls onto her lap, make sure that she when she comes, for instance when you spoke about the South African Post Office, that she knows exactly what our concerns are and what type of reporting we're looking for, so that when we invite, when she comes and appears before us, she doesn't say, no, this was a Mampo's thing, I'm not aware of it. And anybody else must come and report to us on the issues, but the board is in your court as far as it's concerned, because you have got those things. Okay? Okay. Thank you so much, National Treasury. You are free to stay with us. We still have got about two items which must finish. But if you have heard enough of us, we are free to. Yeah, but thank you very much.
If you are running to the airport, Chairperson, we would love to stay.
Okay, that's fine.
Thank you.
Mampo, as I said, that I definitely would like to have a conversation amongst about some of the things that came up here. Okay?
Thank you
so much. Honourable members, one item that we jumped was the question of apologies. Darren, let's note the apologies. Honourable Kwankwa apologized, and Honourable Tihane said she was going to join us. She has done that. Welcome, Honourable Tihane. Thank you very much. I think we'll go to agenda item number 5. We're looking at the minutes of the 28th, the 29th of November, 3rd and 5th of December 2019. Let's just make sure that we have got those minutes. Starting with the 28th. Okay, 28 and 29 November, 3 and 5 December. Are we having those minutes?
Yeah.
Honorable Kaiso, do you have them? Okay. Sarupen, your body language says you don't have them, so you have. Okay. Okay, can you look at the minutes of the 28th of November 2019, page 1, looking for the correctness of the minutes, page 2, 3, page 4, can you adopt the minutes of the 28th of November, the true reflection of that meeting, Honorable Peters?
I move for the adoption of the minutes of the 28th of November.
Thank you, seconder. Honorable Joseph, seconder. Thank you.
Second, Chairperson.
Thank you. Minutes of the 29th of November 2019. Page 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Move up for the adoption. Kaiso, Saru, Kaiso, move.
Yes, I move, Chair, for adoption of the minutes.
Sarupen?
Chair, I second.
Minutes of the 29th of November 2019, so adopted. Let's go to the minutes of the 3rd of December 2019. Page 1. Page 2. 3. Page 4. Mover for the adoption. Zembo.
Thanks, Chair. I move for the adoption.
Peter.
I second.
Minutes of the 3rd of December 2019 adopted.
5 December 2019, page 1, page 2, page 3, page 4, mover for the adoption of the minutes of the 5th of December, Matafa. Matafa, move for the adoption. Honorable Kumani.
Thank you, Chairperson. I second the adoption.
Kumani, second adoption. So the minutes of the 5th of December 2019 adopted. Thank you.
Chair.
That's it.
Chair, please allow me to smack on that item.
Which one?
The item on adoption of the minutes
of the
5th of December.
Okay. So before the adoption then?
No, it's after. For record purposes.
Okay.
You will know why.
Okay, no, that's fine. Because I want us to adopt the minutes as a true reflection of the meeting.
They are adopted.
Okay. That's fine.
Now, after
adoption.
Okay.
So the minutes of the 5th of December 2019 have been adopted. And this takes care of all the minutes that we had. Honorable Zembo.
Okay.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, on behalf of myself and my family, I feel that I should share words of thanks from my family as from the day I was not present. That is the 5th of December, throughout December and January. You would know that I was overwhelmed by grief within the family, but committee members showed support up until I came back. And I want to put on record that the Lenzana family says thank you so much for your telephone calls, your return, and whatever type of messages and support that you send to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Zembo. And we hope you will be, and the family was comforted. Perhaps on that, because like it's a time of smuggling things.
Okay.
one of the staff members, Musa Zamisa, lost her only sister, his only sister. I think we could just send our condolences to him. He's back, and I was informed by Sifiso here that he's definitely not in a good space because he's the only sibling that he had. He has other sisters. Oh, he's the only boy, he's the eldest. Yeah, okay. So our condolences. Honorable Sheikh.
Sorry, Chair. I see that I'm absent and I don't want to really go back to it, but just to set the record straight, on the 29th of November I'm marked as absent, but I had sent an apology and I have it on record in my phone that I have, unfortunately. Maybe we just...
Can we correct that? Darren, that will be corrected on Honorable Sheikh. Thank you. That takes care of the minutes. Go to the draft program for term 1 of 2020. Do we all have that program in front of us? Honourable members, I'm not going to go through the program. As you know, that it's important that we have this so that we can know exactly what is awaiting us. It's not cast in stone. If there are any changes or proposed changes, we'll come back to the committee and say why the proposed changes. Perhaps some of the things that we've just come out of our discussion may lead to some little bit of amendment to the program. But for now,
can we adopt this as a guide of our program for this quarter? Adoption? Honorable Joseph, move for the adoption of the program. Honorable Dihane, second. So the program is adopted. Honorable members, this takes us to the end of our meeting, first meeting, 2020, wishing you all of the best. Thank you very much. The meeting stands adjourned.